All right, we'll get underway. So thanks for coming along. I'm actually James Hickey, who's sick. Is that right? Anyway, I'm the chair as well as one of the authors, and I'll introduce my co-author, David Sund, graduated from University of New South Wales with first class honours last year. He's now an associate at management consulting firm, LEK Consulting. During his undergraduate degree, he worked with General Insurance Division at Zurich Financial Services, as well as an actuarial consultant, Ernst & Young. He's a member of Outcomes Australia, and his interests include social entrepreneurship and youth leadership. So how it'll work is I'll just say a few words. I'll hand it over to David to introduce what's been done here, and then I'll talk a bit about the detail. Normally it works the other way. Normally I introduce and my co-author does the detail, so we decided to mix things up, and then we'll have questions, discussion. So basically I guess we know that in many countries around the world, including Australia, a substantial asset that individuals have is their house, and it's illiquid. And when you get to retirement and you need access to liquidity, then one of the ways you can do that is through these reverse mortgage type products. And the potential for this market, I guess, is fairly significant. It's been growing in the US, UK, now in Australia. But there's some interesting issues. When you look at the research and the industry work on these the modelling, the key issue is the risk around the house price, because if the house price falls and you've lent against the house, then there's a negative equity loss that the provider can face, and it's like an option. So most of the analysis that's done on this is fairly simplistic models in a sense, so that they can price the option using an option pricing formula. So what we've tried to do is look at more sophisticated modelling, and then I guess the other issue is there are lots of risks around this, and one of the risks is related to termination. And so typically you might just assume termination is based on mortality. You die and you move out of the house, the loan gets repaid. And sometimes there's an allowance there, and it's based on a multiple of the female mortality rate for termination, ill health and those sorts of things. And there's more data coming out so we can see more clearly what those termination rates look like. And they have a huge impact on the cost and pricing of the product. So how do you look at that termination? That was another thing that was looked at in the paper. And then finally, I guess, when you do look at this in terms of pricing and risk-based capital and so on, there's not a lot of detailed analytics around the risks and the sensitivity of the risks to all the factors that drive the actual product pricing, and particularly with the global financial crisis where we saw spreads increase so much. So it might be of interest to have a look at sensitivities behind these products. And we do the modelling. We use a 65-year-old case just to illustrate what's going on in the modelling. Obviously, a lot more could be done. But that's sort of the background, and I'll hand it over to David to introduce, and then we'll talk briefly about the details.
Good morning, everyone. I think Mike's done a really good job of just covering my section. I don't know, I have much left to say. So just recapping what Mike was saying, setting the context for this. The volume of talk surrounding how this generation of baby boomers who are poor in liquid savings like super and other financial assets that can be easily liquidated, how they're going to fund their retirement was really what was really the question that the reverse mortgage product was trying to answer. And the question that the reverse mortgage product itself poses is that being an innovation that really only came in around in large volumes around the early 90s or late 80s in the US, and with not much data or experience since then, and certainly not in Australia, how do you go about assessing the risk, and how do you go about constructing a framework by which to assess the risk to the lender? And so that was the context of the analysis. The background information, here's just some background information on how reverse mortgage products and how the market has grown in Australia. And so if you go to the association or the body of lenders, the association that represents all the reverse mortgage lenders in Australia. It's called Senior Equity Release Australian Lenders. You see some fairly robust increases in the volume of reverse mortgages being sold, as well as in the value of reverse mortgages being sold. And potentially, obviously, depending on how things happen on a government level, you could see this market growing more and more as you have more and more retirees whose bulk of savings is in the slide that's been gone. But you'll find that more than 50% of the savings for that particular age group that we're interested in, that's really going to be retiring in the next 5 to 10 years, is in owner-occupied dwellings. And when it comes to facing the fact that, well, if they want to retire on more than just the old age pension, what are they going to be accessing, and what product is going to be filling that gap, that need? One of the logical conclusions, and certainly one of the things that really come to mind, would be, how am I going to access the built-up equity that I have in my home? So the model that we used to go about trying to price this, as Mike mentioned, generally in this field, people have used options pricing models, so a Black-Scholes option pricing model. The problem that has faced generally has been that what you find with house prices is that there's quite a large sort of lag effect, in that the lags of house prices are good, or tend to be significant explanatory variables in predicting next period's house prices. So there's a momentum effect. And when there's a momentum effect, Black-Scholes doesn't work so well. So we, in terms of modelling on a macroeconomic level, just trying to capture key variables, a model that would do that and do it well, and certainly used quite a lot in the literature, is a vector autoregressive model, which is essentially a multivariate autoregressive model. Now, the data that we used were fairly standard sort of macroeconomic data, Reserve Bank, ABS. And one thing to note here is that this analysis was only done for Sydney houses. So, again, this was sort of a simplistic illustrative analysis of taking this framework for analysing or assessing the risk and just applying it to this one area as an example. So there's obviously a lot more work to be done there. The model fits, so here are the errors. The model fits, certainly found T fit better than a Gaussian. I won't hand it for Mike now, actually, just to talk about some of the key, or what we found to be the key sensitivity areas, and how, or which ones you would focus on in terms of getting a good idea of which were the critical risks you would need to mitigate in designing a product like a reverse mortgage.
Okay, so one of the things about the product is it's very much like a life insurance contract, even though it's in the banking area. I guess this is one of the issues that APRA is probably going to have to address about this product, and there's also some other issues about accounting and all that sort of stuff. It's all the issues that you have in life insurance products, upfronting of profit and all that sort of stuff. They're floating around in this product, and they haven't really been well addressed. But that wasn't something we were trying to focus on. We were trying to look, I guess, really at what are the risk factors driving the product, and have a look at the sensitivities, have a look at the tail risks, if you like, and quantify that, and then do some illustrative numbers on a particular type of product. The loan termination rates, is the sort of standard assumption that's used in this area, is take the female mortality rate, multiply it by 30%, and these are the termination rates to be used. In the US, they've been issuing this product long enough to collect data, and so there's been a couple of studies looking at actual data. And so obviously actual data, if you have people terminating earlier, that means that the proportion of people around for you to pay out on the guarantee is less. It's the typical insurance guarantee product. If you have people lapsing, right, it can be less expensive because they don't hang around to claim the benefit, if you like. Depends on, obviously, on the lapse assumptions and so on. So this is something important, and we wanted to have a look at the US experience and then look at impact of, for example, longevity improvements. If you allowed for longevity improvements on this assumption, how does that also impact the pricing and the risk measures for the product? So, and when it comes to the product, it's like, you know, most of the insurance products that we see, that you charge a price and then down the track there's benefits that are paid. And the nature of this benefit is that, you know, when people die, there may not be a benefit paid. There's an option feature, and the option feature depends on the value of the house. So you make a loan, the loan accumulates with interest, and there's uncertainty about that interest. It'll be a floating rate, for example, and then it's secured against the house, and when the person dies, the value of the house fluctuates, and, of course, the risk is that the loan accumulates much more than the value of the house. When the person dies, you meet that loss. Products are issued under this no negative equity guarantee, so you don't have recourse to the individual, it's recourse only to the house value. And so there are going to be scenarios where that pays off. It's an option type feature, and issuers of this product may buy insurance to cover that. And we've basically looked at, if you were an insurer of this product, in terms of insuring that no negative equity guarantee, what would the cash flows look like? What would be the premium that you would charge? Obviously, the product provider would need to load into their rates an allowance for the cost of this insurance and the risks around it also. And obviously, if you were doing risk-based capital and looking at capital issues and profitability, you'd also have to do this type of analysis. So the type of cash flows you see are deferred a long time when people start to die or leave the house, and they're only paid off when value of the house is not sufficient to cover the accumulated loan. So the typical, there are very different types of reverse mortgage. The one we've looked at here is you have a certain loan amount and it accumulates with interest. But there are different structures. You can get an income stream that accumulates up with interest. You can have a drawdown facility. So there's lots of different structures to this, and we've looked at particular structure. Now, obviously, if you make a loan of a certain amount and there's a lump sum, and that person then uses that, and typically, although we've used age 65, these products would typically be used where they have that lump sum feature for someone at older ages, 75, 85, for example, widows, for example, who may need liquidity at those older ages for a variety of purposes. In terms of if you're providing retirement income, then the structure would normally, you'd like to see, would be one where you draw down an income and that income accumulates up as a loan against the property. But if you're drawing down lump sums up front, then the percentage of the house value you can actually lend is fairly small, right? At 65, our example is 15%. So it sounds like, you know, not much. You've got a very valuable house and you want to borrow a lump sum. You can't borrow much. Well, of course you can't, because of the risk that the value of the loan will exceed the value of the house. But if you have an annuity stream type product or some different structure to the product, then these numbers change, of course. But you get a bit of an idea in terms of looking at, say, someone at 65 wanting to access the cash in their house, maybe to invest and then generate an income in terms of their retirement. This shows risk measure. So we look at the standard things, value at risk and also tail value at risk in terms of the product. We use the standard sort of termination rate, standard investment return assumption on the loan, and we have a look at the different risk measures. There's no real surprise. So this is the 99%, this is the 95% value at risk. Further out in the tail, obviously, the risk measure becomes larger. These are the tail value at risks. And then you're working out the expected loss beyond the value at risk, and it's always higher, as you expect. So, but this shows that the numbers on the typical product are things that you need to take into account, obviously, and people do. There's a cost for doing this. So this is the standard risk measures that we use. We use both value at risk and tail value at risk. And then if you call it the default risk on the loan, in other words, when the loan gets repaid and there isn't enough value in the equity of the house to pay off the loan, well, what happens, of course, is you can see these are the termination survival curves. So this is telling you when the terminations occur, and this is the value of the actual default loss, if you like. And obviously, what happens, of course, is the amount of losses occur further out in ages, because you have to accumulate the loan amount so that it does exceed, with a certain probability, the house value. And so what happens, of course, is there's a lot of terminations early on, right, where you don't have the risk, and then there are smaller amounts later on where there is the risk. And the termination rate's very important. It's like the lapse rate on life insurance products. So if you just allow for mortality and you don't take this into account, and you don't take into account, for example, the impact of longevity or the impact of the US experience, which shows things are quite different actually to what you would project just with the survival curve from mortality, then the numbers vary quite a lot, right? So if you just make sort of standard assumptions, just do pricing on the standard assumptions, then the numbers may be not giving you the right picture of the risk that you're running. This just shows, we did lots of sensitivity analysis in terms of, well, you've got a cost of funds, if you like, and you've got a loan rate, and there's a spread, and what happens to that spread, and what's the risk in terms of the amount of the loss in terms of the spread. Basically, to look at what happened if you look at the financial crisis when cost of funds blows out. Back where we start. So spread risk is very important, and you can see the impact of on the shortfall as the spread increases, and that's what you'd expect. It's good when you do research and all the results are what you expect, and then you write it up and people say, well, that's what we expected. I said, well, we had to do it to know we get what we expected. Anyway, so here's the termination rate. So this is looking at sensitivity of the tail value at risk to different termination rates. You can see here's our base case, 30% of the female mortality rate. And this is based on some study.
The US experience,
right? And this is 1% longevity improvement, 1.5% longevity improvement, and you can see this shift in the tail value at risk. So you can see that by incorporating the fact that there's a lot more early terminations than if you just use 30% of the base case. Here's the longevity improvement, which is what you expect, right? Because people are living longer, the loan's accumulating more, so the risk is higher. But when you terminate earlier, right, then obviously the risk is getting lower because fewer people are getting out into the tail. So it just highlights the fact that it's like lapse rates in life insurance, right? And it's the same issue here. So if people are terminating earlier, then, okay, you might price it so that it's cheaper because you think it's cheaper. But the problem is, of course, that you know maybe they won't be terminating early in the future. So what's the realistic termination rate to use? Australia, we don't have much experience to say what it's going to be, but the US experience is certainly that people do terminate this product, and that reduces the cost of the guarantee on the negative equity. And then it's all about looking at the pricing and the relevant risk measure. As you vary the price, you obviously influence the risk measure, as you would expect. Charging higher price, you reduce the expected loss, the amount of loss in future time periods. This shows premium basis points going higher and lower, and shows the sensitivity of the value at risk as we vary that price. And that's exactly what you expect, right? You get this linear effect in the value at risk. Here's the resulting probability as we vary the premiums. So it's what we know, right? So, but there's a market out there with an appropriate premium to be charged. You set a certain premium, it influences your actual expected value of risk. Obviously, it's very sensitive to those assumptions around the termination rate, and it's also very sensitive in terms of the spread risk. This is showing in terms of those problem of survival. It's basically the value at risk, probability of ruin, if you like, around the value at risk. And it shows exactly the impact of different assumptions about termination. So the US experience is the top line, the bottom line is with a 1.5% per annum longevity improvement. So as you increase the longevity improvement, people living further into the time period where the equity guarantee has value, you can see that the probabilities of survival fall. Right? Obviously, the product becomes less supportable in terms of the guarantee that's being given. So this really highlights issues around pricing and risk. The product is not really just something that you can just put aside and say everything will be fine. You need to have a careful look at these issues. So I guess wrapping up, the credit crisis sort of focused attention on risk margins, credit margins, and so this is one of the aspects of this product. We've also seen the product grow in terms of its number of people buying into this product in the US, now starting in Australia. It's also more general than that in Europe, they're looking at it. But we need to really understand the risks. There's this house price risk. There's the characteristics of a life insurance type product. It's in a banking area, so the regulators have to think carefully about it. The accounting rules around these sorts of products are an issue. It's potentially possible to upfront a lot of the premium and take it out, and then what are the capital issues that you need to address around that. But our main purpose was, when you look at the studies that have been done on this area, the typical model is a model for house price, which is normally log normal, a model for interest rates, it's order aggressive but independent of the house price. You then get some option pricing formula to price it. There's not much analytics around the risk and sensitivity, and so we wanted to look at a model that econometricians have been using, looking at house pricing, and modify that to this application, and then to do a little bit more closer analysis, particularly around the termination rates. When you look at the US experience, you can see it's quite different to the assumptions that are typically made. Now, the caution behind that is that the experience in terms of termination rates is terminations much earlier, a lot of lapsing earlier on. Right, so if you start using those assumptions to price, and then people start hanging around, not lapsing the product, for example, then you've got the same sort of issues you face in life insurance as well. So having set that as the background, I'm going to open it up for people to make comments, ask questions, provide discussion. I have the microphone. Who would like to start?
Ken Griffin. Given the potential for this sort of product to, I can't say I'm actually a fan of these products. I'm a little bit nervous about them for various reasons, but staying with the scope of the paper. Given the potential of this in the Australian market to release funds for retirement, so say if we look out 5 or 10 years and you get a significant number of people utilising these, I imagine that the events where house prices would move such that they were under the amount of the loan effectively wouldn't may be a matter for one or two people, but it's likely to also be an event where you would have a concentration in an area. So worst case scenario, you could get 15% of the North Shore of Sydney suddenly. How would you then allow for that as sort of a feedback into this? Because you could see that if these sort of things occur, that in itself becomes a further depressor, because the banks end up with large tracts of housing, which has happened before on the North Shore.
When we started the project, I had ambitions of accessing data at a much more detailed level to do some more detailed modelling, but to do that it takes time, and so we stuck with basically the index level. But yeah, you're right. ARPI data have this hedonic pricing model and so on, and we did some work a few years ago with Residex modelling spatial property prices, and so this is
sort of early work in part of a project we're doing, which APRA are actually supporting as well, where we're looking at retirement type products, including reverse mortgage. So on our list of things to do is to actually have a closer look at the spatial variability and factors driving house prices, and also to have a closer look at this product from a regulatory point of view.
Yeah, and I think one of the other critical factors in that is looking at the link between, and because termination rates are so important, looking at the link between how the consumers plan to use these products and in what context they're using them. And that's really what drives the termination rates. So I've talked to a practitioner here in Australia and asking, well, is your experience more like this 1.3 times fetal mortality, or is it more like what the US is seeing, a lot more early terminations? And his feedback has been, well, it's a lot more like the US because people aren't using this as some sort of annuity stream into the future. They're using it as a bridging loan. And if you think of it like that, and certainly in the US, some of the risks they recognise is that, yes, when house prices take a big dip, because of this no-neg equity guarantee, people tend to want to get out. So it's not enough just to say house price taking a big dip and say, well, we expect people to be leaving at the same rate. It's like, no, your losses might actually be compounded by the fact that, you know, people don't. People see that they're not going to pay off these loans anyway, and they're just going to get out. And they're going to get out with what they can, and they're going to get out and find new accommodation.
Yeah, that's one of the nervous about these products. I mean, if you actually see them going to completion, then you effectively have a death product at the end, and all you're really doing, in actual fact, is you're securitising the death product, and the house is just the asset which is facilitating it. It's where people want to exit halfway. They've taken the lump sum, they've spent it, and then you get all sorts of social implications of people on a current affair talking about, you know, the fact that I can't get the value of my house, etc., etc. And I know that's outside the scope of the paper, but that's the sort of operational side of these that makes me very nervous, because I can see a social risk or a risk that there'll be intervention.
Yeah, I think that's part of what drove this sort of more a greater need for more detailed risk analysis, was that this no-neg equity guarantee was really driven by reputational damage that was done in the UK when these loans were recourse to the borrower. So if your house value didn't cover the loan, we're going to come after you and make sure you pay off the rest. And that's where you get, you know, the tabloid newspapers really beating up on these products. And so this no-neg equity guarantee really introduces a lot of those risk issues.
James Atkinson. In the conclusions of the paper, it talks about a 60 to 70 basis point premium per quarter as being adequate at a 99% probability level. And then later on it goes to say that market premiums are of the order of 20 to 30 basis points and that this is probably okay. So I'm interested in the difference between the 60 to 70 versus the 20 to 30.
I think that comment may have been made in the context of just my discussions with one of the practitioners in the area, and that was really reflective of what are your termination rates looking like. So 60 to 70 is based on a conservative assumption that people are leaving according to 1.3 times the fetal mortality rate. But if everyone's using these as short-term loan or sort of bridging finance type products, then you're much less likely to see the defaults occurring. So I guess the caveat I'd add with that 20 to 30 being appropriate is that if reverse mortgage is seen as a legitimate annuity product that goes on top of the old age pension and runs concurrently to it, then obviously we're looking at a much higher premium being necessary. But at the moment in the market, with the way people are using them in the US and early indications of how they're using them here, 20 to 30 seems reasonable.
And sorry, the second part to the question, if it's okay. So 60 to 70 points would be on the basis of a risk transfer to an insurer. If an Australian bank were to hold capital against these loans, what sort of level of capital would you expect they'd be looking at?
Mike, did you want to take that?
Plenty of time, and we can have an early lunch.
Interested in if the market were to develop and become competitive, then there'd be an element of potentially refinancing to someone who came out and offered a better rate. So how would that impact on the... So if rather than somewhat customers holding these lines for 20 or 30 years, they may only hold them for a couple of years before refinancing to a competitor who comes out with a better rate. What impact might that have?
I don't think that's something we've looked at, but certainly that would be a next step. There's been some analysis done in the US on that in terms of how or the pricing implications of it, certainly. Like, what would trigger? How much would be necessary to trigger someone to decide to refinance? But, yeah, that's a next step, and that's not something that we've looked at yet. Unless, Mike, you've got something further to add on that.
It's a classic, it's like a life insurance product, and that's the risk, you know. I mean, the problem with that is basically the expenses involved. If it's not a expensive transaction, there's not all these commissions and so on, then maybe it's not an issue. But certainly, I mean, that's the problem.
If you pre-funded the option cost, you should actually make more profit.
Yeah,
so
potentially.
Because the refinancing, you will pay off the mortgage, you'll get the money back.
I think it's fair to say the way they're being used in Australia, I don't think is the way they should be used in terms of what you need to use them for. I mean, basically, what should happen really is when you get to the older age, and you see that in particularly in the US where they do get used, older ages, mainly females, you want to stay in your house, but you need to modify your house, you're ill and so on, and so you need some access to cash and an income, and you're older, and then this is a way you can do that. Creates liquidity in your house without having to move into a nursing home, for example, right? So it alleviates that problem.
And what I was saying earlier, the other way you can think about this is you can buy, if you buy a death benefit product, pure death product at, say, age 65, at some point in the future that's going to pay out $100,000, then in theory you should be able to borrow against that as an asset to get a certain amount of money now. In actual fact, that's basically what you're... If you protect at the end with a death policy, that's all you're actually doing. The house is just a facilitator to actually get you the loan. And then at the end of the period, the death policy pays off the loan and you get the family, your estate gets to keep the house. If you do that, you're really just securitizing the death policy back so you can use it as collateral. And it works within the banking environment.
I mean, the big issue is the amount of assets that we have in many countries, but in Australia particularly, in our house. I mean, that's our major form of saving. I mean, retirement saving through the superannuation guarantee is increasing, but You know, the majority of our assets, for many, most individuals, is tied up in a house. And then if you want to unlock that and use that in retirement, and you don't have a bequest motive and you don't want to transfer it all to your next generation, then, you know, this is a product of creating that liquidity, but it's got lots of issues around it. And, you know, when I first saw these products, I mean, admittedly it was probably in the early 80s and they weren't very popular, but I saw some of the early attempts to launch these products in Australia and I just thought they were rip-offs to the way they were doing it in those days. But I think it's improved a lot, but I think there's lots of issues to be addressed around it. But it has the potential to become quite significant, and potentially it's going to be needed because you're going to have this asset, you want to convert it to, you're getting older and you need to stay in your house, you want to stay in your house, you need to make modifications, you need extra income for, you know, your health care and so on. So how do you get access to the liquidity? If you sell your house and move into, you know, aged care and so on, that may not, you know, people don't want to do that. They want to have the flexibility to stay in their house. And then there's an extra cost, and so how do you manage that? So I think it's going to be something that, you know, it's going to happen, and we just need to make sure that it's in the right regulatory home and the way people look at it is right and people understand it. And it's the same with all these retirement products. There's, you know, there's an education process that needs to go on. Just with buying lifetime annuities, you have to understand that if you want longevity income protection, then you have to give up liquidity. If you allow liquidities, like the variable annuities, allow the liquidity, you're not going to get lifetime income protection because you'll take your money out for some other reason before you get the protection.
One of the difficulties with these is it's sort of, using your terminology, you also give up flexibility. So some of the ones I saw, for example, in the UK environment, which is why these things are shiver down my spine, is, you know, people would set these up when they're 65 and they'd have it basically set up on the assumption they would stay in their house. But if someone in 20 years' time decides they want to move to a different house, or they want to move into a housing, or they get married again, or so, you know, all sorts of life events, which suddenly meant people would get mid-contract and come back and say, oh, well, I want to make changes. And the answer, it's a little bit bent to the scope of the paper. The thing is, well, by the time we unwind all this, you're not actually going to have much money left because of the way the housing market's moved, etc. And that's actually where the advice aspect really becomes important.
Well, I think one of the challenges is also the perception about this product. So, for example, my father-in-law is retired, and he couldn't get access to the super year because of the age. And I told my husband, what if, you know, he considers something like that? And the response was, well, it's the perceived value that, you know, the house is the only asset he's got. If you're going to get a loan, you know, what I have, I've got nothing at the end of the day. So it's that perception, so that's one of the challenges. But it's very interesting talk here, and I find it quite insightful. Just a comment on the house, the property market. You're saying that you're looking at the property market model and all that, because I work at QB Mortgage Insurance, for London Mortgage Insurance, and apparently look at property markets and all that. One of the companies that's looking at it, it's APM, Australian Property Monitors. They approached us very recently and said that they're actually developing a property market model that looks at SSD level. That might be something you might want to look at if you're looking for that sort of stuff. I know there's an economist, Matthew Bell, I think. He's only just developing the model and he's finishing at the state level and he's looking into the SSD level. And that's one of the things we're looking at perhaps using the model result to do some of our stuff. But since you mentioned, I thought I'd just let you know, maybe that's something of interest to you as well.
Yeah, we actually had a look at, I think, APM use a stratified geographic model that was based on, I think, a paper that two RBA economists wrote. Unfortunately, because the methodology was only introduced in 06, we couldn't get a long enough time series for that. But certainly, it performed very, very well, and certainly comparable to even what RPData was doing with its hedonic modelling. So, yeah, that's definitely an index that we'd keep in mind for the future.
Yeah, thanks. Is Matthew Bell with Australian Property Monitors now, is he? He was with RP Data, wasn't he?
I think it's interesting, even with a company like RP Data, I think RP Data is linked into or actually does try and offer equity financing as well for buying a house. So in terms of the applicability of these sorts of models, and if you're looking at solutions to increasing housing unaffordability, it certainly has some applications there as well.
Any other comments? Otherwise, we can wrap it up. So let's thank the speakers. And thank you all for coming along and enjoy your lunch. And I appreciate your comments. Very useful. Thank you.